Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for rural grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Liz Carlson, and I'll be the host for this training. Today's topic is advocacy for women with substance abuse issues. I'm joined on the line by our guest speaker today, Patty Bland, the director of the Train the Trainer Project of the Alaska Network for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault in Juneau, Alaska. Welcome, Patty. Hi.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
So I'm delighted to have Patty on the line today. She is busy like you would not believe. She, it seems to me, must be training more days and on the road more than she is in her office. So we're very lucky to be able to get her. Before Patty begins, I'm not going to formally introduce Patty today because I believe you all have received her bio. But Patty, would you mind just kind of giving us a little more information about your experiences and how it is that you have kind of come to this work to get us grounded in the topic today, and then just go ahead and jump into your PowerPoint.
Sure. Thank you. I've actually been working in I was hired by New Beginnings Shelter for Battered Women back in 1989, and it was after working a number of years in the substance abuse arena. And at that time, so many women were coming through alcohol drug treatment, and seemed like they weren't just experiencing issues with substance abuse, but that they were actually having a lot of significant problems with battering and sexual assault and sexual abuse. So that was one of the reasons that I became interested in working in the domestic violence field. And once I started working in the shelter, of course, I began looking at substance use issues in a different way, less like a treatment issue and more like a barrier to safety or a tool that a batterer might use to gain or maintain control, a mechanism of control. And I began to see how substance abuse issues actually impact a person's safety. It impacts their capacity to maintain autonomy, and it often reduces their ability to access justice. And so I kind of had a shift in focus and began to think about these things in different ways. And really, I think I got completely co-opted by the Battered Women's Movement, and it's been a good thing. I worked at New Beginnings for about 12 years, and during that time, we began doing support groups for people with substance use issues following a serious incident at the shelter where one of the women who had sought services had to be asked to leave due to her drinking and drug use issues, and a short time after she died. And that had a very negative impact on all of us, and we began thinking that, I think this was in 90 or so, that maybe we should do a better job at figuring out ways to help people stay safe who had both substance use and domestic violence issues. And so due to that issue, we started doing support groups at midnight on Thursday nights at New Beginnings in the early 90s. And what happened was it was a good idea in a lot of ways because people with addiction issues were awake. They weren't sleeping. And we didn't have to look for child care at midnight. And it turned out to be very helpful. In those early groups, you know, I learned a lot from women because just about every idea I had as a substance abuse professional at that time was inappropriate and didn't work very well with battered women. But they educated me and took the time to really make anything that I do offer to you rooted in their experience rather than in mine. And so over time, many of the women who left shelter wished that there was some type of option for them to be able to have support when they had left. And in 1992, I think it was, we began a small drop-in group in the community for women with substance abuse issues who also were experiencing domestic violence. And that group was in Seattle, and it was the only one of its kind in the state of Washington. And unfortunately, I mean, what happened was because it was the only one, everyone wanted to go, and it was overwhelming the need. And so we realized that having one little group in Seattle wasn't sufficient. And in 1994, we worked with King County and with the Alcohol Drug Helpline and developed an outreach program so that we could do similar services in battered women's programs in Seattle. And that also led to us being able to do similar services addressing domestic violence issues for women in treatment also in Seattle. And we were able to get ourselves into about 10 or 12 different programs to be able to provide support groups and one-on-one services and advocacy for battered women with substance use issues. And that was we really learned a lot from women then. And so in 2001, I had been doing work up here in Alaska for some time. And also in King County and Seattle, a couple programs decided to open up and just specialize in working with women with both substance use and domestic violence issues. And so I began doing technical assistance to help these programs get started and get off the ground. And I moved up to Alaska and had enough time to sit down at the coalition and write down what we had learned from women over the past, like from 1989 all the way up to 2001, and put together a real tools manual on ideas of how to help people secure safety, sobriety, and justice. So with that, that's the background. Hope I haven't put you to sleep with that.
No, I think that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's a good intro to the rest of the information. So Patty prepared a PowerPoint for this training today. And you'll notice that there's quite a number of slides in that. And so from that, she's going to kind of winnow down and focus on just a few specific slides today. And so she will be sure to kind of mention the slide number so that you can follow along in that PowerPoint if you'd like.
Right. I always give you more stuff. I know I'll never get through all of it, but I'd like you to have some tools that will be helpful. And I've also sent a couple articles that you may find useful over to Liz, and she'll be able to get them to you if you're so inclined. You can let her know. So should we start, Liz?
Yeah. Yep, perfect time. Let's go.
Okay. So the picture, if you're looking at the slides in front of you, one of the things that you're looking at is a big old picture of an iceberg. And I put that there because it's been my experience, if you're working with people who have experienced domestic violence and sexual assault, that generally speaking, oftentimes the person who's harmed them is someone they know or someone they love. And when that happens, a person's ability to trust there isn't any reason to trust when people you love hurt you. And I find that when someone comes and seeks services, they're often guarded and don't necessarily want to tell you everything. They've showed up at the shelter door, they showed up at the transitional housing program, or they've come to us for a specific reason. But a lot of times there are things underneath the surface that may be impacting safety or may be impacting capacity to, you know, respond to advocacy-based counseling, or that may be making their capacity to seek and receive justice have a negative impact on. So I think it's like an iceberg, and I think that part of the reason that I like to do this work is so that we can all have better tools to be able to help a person safely reveal who they truly are so that we can do better advocacy for them. And so what you see when someone comes in the door is just the tip of the iceberg. All the other issues are below the surface, and I know any of you that have experienced know this is true. When I'm on slide 2 now, and what I did is I began thinking about substance abuse and domestic violence, and thinking about how often people use substances as a coping mechanism. And I think because I've worked in the field for a long time, I remember when I first started working, we saw some women with substance use issues, maybe a few. But there were no laws or rules in effect addressing domestic violence, really, on no statutes, et cetera, prior to the mid-90s. And so when I think back on people coming through and seeking services early on in, there wasn't much out there, and there wasn't a lot of supports in place. And a lot of people who came through in the early days were extremely high functioning and capable of tackling you know, really, really insensitive systems. And not that I would say that all systems are sensitive today. There are more options today for battered women. There are protection, or there's capacity to get protection order. There is statutes on the books that criminalize behaviors associated with domestic violence, and there are shelter systems out there now. And so in the early days, it seemed like we saw people that were able to access justice with some degree. But now I think we've really opened the door, and people are quite aware of domestic violence, and more people are able to seek safety without necessarily going through the door first at shelter. I think back in the old days, the first door of hope was shelter, and then we would work really hard to get them to a protection order or something like that if we could find it. Nowadays, I think sometimes coming to shelter is the last port of call for people who are most hopeless and really feel their needs are not, that they can't get them met through any other avenue. And consequently, I think we see people with more and more significant problems in addition to domestic violence. And so if you look at historically, you look at it, I think about in the 80s, we saw maybe 12% of people seeking shelter with a substance abuse problem. By 1991, the Women's Action Alliance found that 60 to 75% of women who were coming in seeking services over a 15-month period had developed problems with some of their original coping mechanisms, alcohol and drugs. In 94, a study of Illinois domestic violence shelters showed that up to 42% of service recipients were using alcohol or other drugs. And you keep looking in Iowa. This is a 2002 study. One in four of the women in the Iowa shelter safe home sample, they had a lifetime diagnosis of alcohol dependence, and another one in four had alcohol or other drug problems. So we're looking at about 50% of people in Iowa shelters with some type of substance abuse problem. And I talked to Bill Downs and Barb Rindles fairly recently, and they tell me their more recent data shows numbers of shelter recipients up to around 60% with some type of substance use problem. So this is kind of significant. So that in the past, in the early days of the Battered Women's Movement, we might have had the occasional person with a substance use issues. Now you could say it's at least half, and maybe the majority of people we're seeing. And so that means we have to do a better job of advocating for people with substance use disorders and substance abuse issues. And I think that it's a twofold problem, because, you know, I know initially when I first began looking at substance use in the context of domestic violence, I focused, and I am now on the third slide, I focused more on substance abuse as a coping tool and thinking about that. But in actual fact, substance abuse is also a mechanism of control that batterers use. And in fact, substance abuse is often encouraged by a perpetrator, you know, to gain control, to maintain control, and undermine a person's competency. Along with that, knowing that that is true, I also know that substance use is a coping mechanism, and most of the data out there tells us that 2/3 of women with a substance use disorder, before they ever began using substances, experienced some type of interpersonal violence. And that really flies in the face of the kinds of old-time thinking where people used to say, if you were drinking, it wouldn't have happened if you hadn't been drinking. And that is such a myth, because many incidences of domestic violence and sexual abuse predate any use of history or any use or history of misuse of substances. So I want to say that the alcohol and drug addiction is not caused by domestic violence and sexual assault, but it is taken advantage of if DV and sexual assault occur. And I'm going to talk in more detail about that. First thing that I want to discuss with you, though, is how domestic violence and substance use interact in terms of the power and control wheel. And it's hard, I think, if you're looking at the slides online or on your paper, it's kind of hard to see that power control wheel. So I'm going to jump over to slide 5 and talk about some of the specific behaviors that batterers engage in to increase risk to their partners and cause harm. And one of the things that's really common is for a batterer to actually introduce their partner to drugs to get them started using. And I don't know how many of you have worked with women with IV drug use, et cetera, but I can tell you after 20 years of being in the substance abuse field and talking to other clinicians around the country that majority of women who begin using IV drug use begin so in the context of a relationship, and they often inject for the first time with a partner playing a role. And I want you to know that when that happens, if a person's in a domestic violence situation, that is a huge mechanism of control. If you're controlling someone's drug supply, if you're doing the injecting, or if you're forcing or coercing a partner to use, that is a form of domestic violence. In fact, I would say, like, if you think about it, if you're in a relationship with an abuser, or you happen to be an IV drug user, and there's one needle to share, who's going to get that needle first? The victim of domestic violence or the perpetrator? And what we hear over and over again is that victims of domestic violence are engaged in drug use with partners in terms of the context of IV use will find that they are often forced to use a dirty needle, dirty cottons, and sometimes the perpetrator will shoot them up with a noxious substance. I don't want to be disgusting or anything, but I have heard stories from women of being shot up with urine and with feces, with toxins. That is something that you generally don't talk about when you're working in a domestic violence shelter. It might not be something that comes up. The level of shame and the fear, people are afraid to discuss it or talk about it. It's just pretty common. And, you know, it's also very common if I'm an abuser, if I'm in a relationship with someone and I'm controlling their drug supply and we're talking about injectable drugs or really any kind of drug, we know that people who use, if they're unable to get their supply, they go into withdrawal and they get dope sick. And I want you to know that there are batterers out there who deliberately make their partners get dope sick and gain compliance and control, you know, by giving them the drugs to get the desired result that they want. So this is not something that, again, people talk about, and it's awful, often shameful, and people hide it, and it goes underground. Batterers do not want their partners to get clean and sober, because if they do, they are harder to control. And so one of the key things that a batterer may do is isolate their partner from recovery and other helping resources. And so they will pull people out of treatment against medical advice. They won't even let them go to treatment. They will humiliate the person if they go to an AA or an NA meeting or any other kind of self-help meeting. They may accuse them of cheating or of having sex with people at meetings. They may try to use homophobic remarks for women that attend women's meetings and things like that. They will do anything they can to undermine a person's capacity to get clean and sober, including calling them up and trying to get them to use, etc. And I can't stress that enough, how often that happens. Coercing the partner to engage in illegal acts is another very key element when we talk about abusers and we talk about the kind of risk they pose to partners. And when we're talking about substance use, generally speaking, part of domestic violence is to engage that partner in dealing the drugs, stealing, or into prostitution. And what you want to know is that, for example, if we have a domestic violence perpetrator and a victim together and they use drugs together, if they are out and about, who is carrying those drugs? You're going to find, if you look at the incarceration rates for women, you're going to see that they're often arrested for holding the drugs. They may be forced into boosting or stealing, and again, trading sex for drugs, and not necessarily just for themselves, but for the partner who is abusing them and says, "Don't come home tonight without an 8-ball, or I'll beat you up." those kinds of things happen. And all recovery efforts are, I shouldn't say all, most many are being sabotaged by the perpetrator. I was just thinking about one of the women that we work with who had been able to get safe from her partner, and but he was a high-risk batterer, and she felt that she should have phone contact with him because if she didn't have phone contact, she was afraid he would turn up at her door on a regular basis. But she's been able to limit any contact with him for approximately 6 months to the occasional phone call, and had actually got herself through treatment through a domestic violence shelter and into a transitional housing program. And things were going pretty good, and she was attending our support group. And this particular day, she came into group, and she told the women in the group that her husband, ex-husband, was going to the hospital, and he was going to have surgery. And she felt that as a decent human being that it would only be right for her to go and collect him at the hospital when he was released. And at that time, I'd been working in the field for quite a while, and I was thinking mostly of safety planning and was it safe for her to see him. She'd kind of been working on distancing herself. Of course, it's her choice what she does, and we made that clear and talked about how she could keep safe when she goes to see him and pick him up and everything. And all was going pretty well, on the safety planning regarding that. And I remember saying, do you really think it's safe? And she said, oh, I figure when he comes out of the hospital, it's the safest time. He's not going to be a threat to me physically. Well, several of the women in the support group were in recovery from substances themselves. And I remember what happened next because one of the group members said, can I just ask you one question? And the woman we were safety planning with said, yeah, sure. And the other woman said, she said, you know, I've been in relationship with people who use for a long time. And I got to tell you, you know, I'm wondering, did your husband tell you if you pick him up at the hospital that he would share his drugs with you when he gets out? Is that the hook he used to get you to come and get him? And I will never forget that because the woman just put her head down and started sobbing and crying. And it turned out that indeed was the hook that he used. He said, babe, you come, I'll share these pills with you. And she'd been feeling kind of down and things were a little flat for her. And what I don't think a lot of people realize is that when you are dealing with making changes in terms of safety, and you're also dealing with changes in terms of keeping your sobriety going, that it could be a struggle. And she realized that her partner was using that drug addiction to, you know, her fact that she was craving and wanted to use, that he was like whispering in her ear to get her to do it, and that it was putting her sobriety and her safety at risk. And so we continued with safety planning, but also encouraged her to get some support and think of other ways to, you know, get through the day without putting herself at risk. And she was able to make a different decision and a different choice, but it was her choice to do so. That's the one thing I want to get clear. We're not trying to tell people what to do. We're just trying to give them information and education so they can make a choice. And for her, it was really suddenly clear that he was using those drugs as a mechanism of control and was going to benefit if she relapsed and slipped. And that would put her, as she said, in a world of hurt. What you're going to find that perpetrators also do is they use drug history as a threat. And this is a particularly significant if you're working with non-documented women, because if you're carrying drugs or using drugs and it's found out, you can get deported and you're not getting back in. And so being addicted to drugs is something where deportation might be used as a threat. The threat of arrest is ever present. It is being reported to Child Protective Services is a constant issue. Concerns regarding custody is an issue, and at work. And these are areas that battered women talk about when they describe how substance use has been used against them. And the other thing that happens is that people with substance use disorders are not unlike anyone else. They take on the views of society regarding what it means to be an addict. It's like a form of internalized depression. And when you think of stereotypes around people with alcoholism and drug addiction, generally speaking, the attitudes of people are not very positive. And people who suffer from chemical dependence and substance use disorders, they often feel those negative stereotypes, and they the shame of it may prevent them from reaching out and seeking help. The other thing that happens is that often the partner blames the abuse that they engage in on their partner's use and say, if you hadn't been drinking, I wouldn't have had to knock you out, et cetera, which is degrading and not true. And what happens is that abusers actually benefit from the negative stereotypes around women where they're not believed if they're using, where they're not perceived as credible or worthy, or where they are rejected from services. What is amazing to me is how often people with a substance use disorder are denied access to domestic violence victim services or ability to use a crisis line regarding sexual assault or something. And so who is benefiting from that? The batterer is benefiting from a lack of services for chemically dependent battered women, and they are benefiting from those societal beliefs regarding women and addiction. So I always think about that. I think if I am not able to ensure service provision for this person, if we are unable to ensure service provision, then the person who benefits the most is the batterer who has been using the substances to gain and maintain control, and that she is being penalized for finding a coping mechanism that many of us might use ourselves. And with that said, I want you to know that when you're working with people with substance use issues, it's not safe to reveal. It's not safe for them to reveal what's really happening in their lives, because most of them know that if they tell you that they're drinking or using, that they're not going to be allowed access into the program. So it's not safe for them to be truthful. And it's really interesting to me. I was thinking about this one time. If a person's doing a screen on substance use before the someone enters, just think about it. If someone had a gun to your head and you knew that if you were drinking or using, you couldn't get in the door, and a person on the end of the phone said, are you drinking or using, what would your answer be? I mean, I know I would say no. And I don't know many people who wouldn't say no. And sometimes people tell the truth and they don't get in or what have you. And so our current policies tend to reward people who don't feel safe enough to tell us what's really happening. And then when we try to provide advocacy for them, there's lots of surprises because we've set it up so that they can't safely let us know what's going on. Now, I can't see you. I don't know how many are out there, but I would pose a question to you. I would like to ask you, and I want you to think about this. How many of you have ever had a drink in your entire life? And I would ask you, how many of you have ever had a little bit of a buzz, like had a little bit of a high from a drink ever in your entire life? And if I were to ask you why you had that drink, I expect there'd be a lot of different answers. And the answers might be fun, peer pressure, kill pain, sleep, all those kinds of things. But I would ask you, if those of you that have ever had even one buzz, did you decide never to use again ever in history, or did you run right into treatment at that moment? Because I doubt that happened. It might not even be necessary. But the thing of it is most people in our culture use something. You know, they use it time or they may misuse. And I would ask you, how many of you have ever had a drug, if you've ever used any drug at all? And that includes caffeine, nicotine, chocolate, all of y'all. If you've ever used drugs at all, and then I would ask you if you've ever misused them. And that might include taking 3 aspirins instead of 2, or drinking 10 cups of coffee, or, you know, taking more of a prescription. Because let's face it, if you've had your wisdom teeth pulled and they tell you to take one codeine tablet every 4 hours, maybe you'll be thinking, 4 codeines every 1 hour might kill this pain. I mean, think about that. And I ask you this because the people we're working with are no different from us. Most people use, many people misuse. Some people find themselves with an addiction. A small percentage of people do, anywhere from like 0.04 up to 12 to 15% might find themselves with a substance use disorder. But you cannot get to that substance use disorder without using or without misusing it. The people we work with aren't that different from us. I just want to stress that. Because sometimes we get ourselves all worked up, and we really shouldn't. But because people are fearful coming into a program, they're fearful of their abuser, they're also afraid of us. We have a lot of professional power. We determine whether they get in, whether they stay in, what happens once they're there. And so the people we're working with, they might be afraid, and so they may be devious or they may lie to survive. If they're in relationship with someone actively, they may encourage that abuser to drink until that person passes out so nobody gets hurt. They'll try reasoning. They'll try lying about the abuser's behavior. They will try to improve their relationship. They do many things. One of the things that people do in abusive relationships to survive is they try to create an internal space that a person can't get to. And if you're working with people with sexual assault, sexual abuse issues, they'll often talk about being detached from themselves or sitting on a windowsill watching what's happening to them, kind of dissociating. And that's a great coping tool. And now more research is coming out that says using alcohol and alcoholism is a form of a dissociation. Using alcohol helps a person dissociate, and alcoholism in and of itself is a form of dissociative disorder. So these are things to think about. Many times a person engaged in an abusive relationship will be forced to have sex to placate an abuser or to protect their kids from violence. And I have not talked to too many people that did not disclose that drinking and using drugs is a very effective tool for numbing pain and for making feelings around stuff like that go away. So these are things you want to be thinking about when you are working with people.
Patty?
Yes.
So I wonder if we might, if you'd be willing to stop for questions and comments.
Sure, fine.
You've covered a really broad ground and touched on a lot of issues, at least briefly. So let's just stop and check in and see where the callers are at. And so if any of you have a question or a comment to make, we'd love to hear it now. And Carrie, can you tell everybody how they could do so?
Absolutely. At this time, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 once on your touchtone phone. All of those questions will be answered in the order that they are received. Pressing the number 1 more than once will actually remove you from the queue, so be careful to press the number 1 only once unless your question has been answered by a previous caller. Our first question comes from Buffalo, Wyoming. Your line is now open.
Are you there?
Are you there? You know, I just bumped a number here. Sorry.
That's okay. Thanks, Wyoming.
Okay, next we'll hear from Missoula, Montana. Missoula, your line's open. Okay, maybe there's no question there after all.
Okay.
And those are the only two questions that were in our queue at this time.
All right. No comments from anyone at this point or concerns?
Okay, we did have somebody else just join from Barrow, Alaska.
Oh, hi.
Good morning, Patty. It's Carolyn Shawley. How are you?
Hi, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm doing marvelous. And first of all, just very briefly want to thank you for all of your years of doing this work and doing it with the passion that you do. You've been up to Barrow several times, and as you well know, we have a large number of our ladies who are either addicted to alcohol, drugs, or both. How, Patty, would you suggest, because I'm teaching a women's education group, how would you suggest that I open the gates for them to feel comfortable to talk to me about these rather painful subjects so that we can use some of the tools you give me?
Well, that's a good question.
The shame is horrible up here. You know that.
Yeah, the shame is bad. I mean, not just in Beryl, but really anywhere when you're talking about alcohol and other drug and domestic violence or sexual assault issues. And the thing that I found most useful is in framing things in such a way where the person feels respected, but where we normalize conversations about substances and we make it's something we do for everybody, we address it with everyone, and we normalize it. And so generally speaking, what I'm doing is when I'm, like, if I'm in a group setting or even one-on-one, a lot of times what I will do is I'll start out by asking people, you know, by talking to people about, you know, if someone's in your group or in your program, one of the first things you can do is you can validate the fact that they have found the courage and strength to reach out, seek safety, look for assistance, and you may explore with them what it was about them that made it possible for them to actually have the courage to pick up the phone and call or to come or to be here and to really discuss with them, you know, that positive strength about them that you know. And when you ask someone, you say to someone, you know, you have a lot of courage, you reached out to seek help and we're here for you. What made it possible? What do you think it was about you that was that gave you the strength to make up that call? A lot of times they may not know, or they may be able to say, I was just sick and tired of putting through it. I care about my children. I knew the time was now. I've endured long enough. They'll come up with different things, and then I may follow up with, well, you know, you didn't have just the strength and the courage to make this call. You had a lot of strength and strong qualities to be able to actually survive being in the relationship and for however long they were. And you'll talk to people that might have been in an abusive relationship a few months or several years and to say, somehow or other on a day-to-day basis, you were able to cope with this. What is it that made it possible for you to survive and endure for this length of time? Because to be able to do that means you had some really great qualities. And they, you know, sometimes they'll talk about their faith or their religion, or they'll talk about their kids or their family or friends. But battlers systematically eliminate so many different supports. And yet if you're in a group setting, you see I haven't said a word about alcohol or drug. At this point, I've actually spent time, you know, helping them think about what's happening now and the strengths and tools that they use to get them where they were in the past. And then generally, after they are feeling good about themselves and they identify strengths, I then may go back and say, if for example, someone tells me they were able to get safe because, you know, they made that call because they knew they had enough, and that what got them through all these years was their stubbornness and persistence or their care for their kids, I'm going to go back and say, well, I'm glad that you had that strength and I'm glad you had that care for your kids. And I do have to tell you, though, that many, many women I see tell them the thing that gets them through the day or makes it possible for them to cope is to take a drink, to pop a pill or smoke something. How often does that work for you? Because that's often a very good coping tool. And let me tell you that when you frame it that way, you're not acting like drinking or drug use is wrong. You're just acting like it's a normal way to deal with things. And then people will often talk about it. And if they do talk about it, which most people will, sometimes they'll say, oh, no, that's not the case. You have let it out as a general question that you would ask anyone, so they don't feel that there's a Kmart blue light around them that says you're the drinker, you're the drugger. You know, you're kind of saying, well, a lot of people tell me this is the quickest way or what have you. And I might follow up with, well, if they say that they did, you know, that they do or whatever, I might say, oh, can you tell me any reason why it might not be safe for you to use substances when someone's trying to hurt you or when someone's trying to kill you? How do you think substance use could impact your safety. So we're talking about it in terms of safety, not in terms of you're a bad person, you're this, you're that. And that might be a great way, a great starting point to be able to have conversations about safety. And I would tell you that probably better than half the people you talk to, if you talk to them about their substances in a non-judgmental way, as if it's a reasonable response to violence, that just giving them information on some of the safety risks associated with substance use will be sufficient to help them rethink other safer coping mechanisms. And but for maybe, oh, it could be 10 to 15% of the people you talk to, having a conversation, if they have a significant addiction, may not make it possible for them to stop using. And for another group, it may be too painful to get through the day without using, that they're not maybe willing to consider, or they may have challenges thinking of other alternatives. But you want to open the door and begin that way. I think normalizing it is really important, Carolyn.
Thank you, Patty.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Carolyn. That was a good question for all of us.
Any other questions?
That was the last question in our queue for now.
Okay. Do you want me to move forward?
Yeah, I wonder, Patty, about I think that was a good, Carolyn's question was a good segue into talking about screening. And so
right, and I was just going to say, I have on here some slides where you can see, you know, when you're talking on the telephone, there's things that you might recognize or things that you might see on site. But there are things that you can actually read on the slides, and those would be like your slides 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I'm going to jump past the liver stuff. Before I get into screening, though, I want to hit on slide 16 some of the reasons that make screening a challenge. And one of the problems, you know, when we are screening is that when you use substances, there are some distortions in perception that might occur. And people will often mix up blackout and pass out as if they're the same thing. If a person passes out, they've fallen asleep or they've become unconscious from excessive alcohol and other drug consumption. And so that's what a pass out is. But when a person actually uses alcohol or other drugs, when they put a substance into their body, it affects memory and it affects recall. And memories, if you put something into your body, and it doesn't matter who you are, you don't have to be an alcoholic or addict, any of us, if you've ever been to a party and then you were sober and your friend was not, and you talked about it the next day, you'll often think you were at two separate events, if you think about it. That's because memories formed under the influence are often distorted. And so you're going to find that if a person is drinking or using, there may be challenges when they try to determine what occurred or what's going on. Should blackout occur, and that doesn't happen for everyone, and it doesn't happen for everyone who has a diagnosable substance use disorder, but if a blackout does occur, it's an amnesia-like period that's often associated with heavy drinking or other sedating drug use. And so a blackout, if you can't remember what happened, it can leave you particularly vulnerable. You could wake up with black and blues, and your partner could tell you you tripped, and you might not know that partner threw you down the stairs. So, or you might not remember things that happened. So these are issues that battered women with substance use disorders face. Blackout is a particular problem because you could have made a 911 call and talked to a police officer and then not be able to give accurate recall of the event at court, like six, you know, when it finally goes to court later. So these are things to be aware of. So I'm going to jump over to slide 21, and I'm going to tell you that if you're looking at that when we're talking about an active form of abuse, to me an active form of abuse is when a human being is trying to hurt somebody. And that could be through domestic violence or child abuse or sexual assault. It can also be through emotional, physical, economic abuse. It can be through oppression. An active form of abuse to me would also be racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, wherever anyone is trying to harm someone, hurt someone, make someone feel bad about themselves.
those active forms of abuse, often all these things kind of co-occur. So if I see one of those active forms of harm, you know, impacting an individual, I'm going to look to see if any of the others are there as well. And generally speaking, if someone is making a person feel bad about themselves or treating them poorly, people find ways to cope with this. And a lot of ways to cope makes sense. But, you know, a lot of times if we're trying to cope with something, it's from a problem that might last a couple of days or a week. But I got to tell you, the experience of oppression can be a lifelong experience. The experience of violence can be years and years. Sexual abuse, incest, these things can take years and years. And so sometimes some of the things that we use to cope become problems as well. So if you look at ways a person might cope, it could be with substances, it could be with gambling or with food, it could be with shopping or shoplifting, working too much. I'm sure none of you do that, right? Sexually acting out, it can be shopping, shoplifting, all these kinds of things a person might use. And if a person picks substances, because that's what we were talking about today, since domestic violence doesn't tend to get better, it tends to get worse, a person's use may cause problems down the road. And that is why when I'm working with someone and trying to figure out what's keeping them going and where they can draw strength and what their safety issues are, I'm not asking about substance abuse to make it impossible for someone to get services at my program. I am asking about substance use to find out whether or not that substance use is creating a barrier to safety, it's impacting her capacity to benefit from advocacy-based counseling, if it's reducing her choices or impacting her autonomy, and I want to know if that substance abuse is going to be used against her to prevent her from justice, prevent her from getting custody. It's a very big difference. It is not about me being a substance abuse professional. It's about being a battered women's advocate, and how do we advocate for people who are having their substance use become an element of power and control. You want to look at it that way because that is what's happening. And I know if you work in the domestic violence field, all of you probably really hate it when somebody says, why doesn't she just leave? Because there's a million reasons why a person may or may not choose to leave, and many battered women never do. It's safer for them, or they feel that their interests lie where they, you know, in the way that they choose. Why doesn't she just leave is the wrong question when you're working in a domestic violence field. Makes you just, I know all of you, you hate when you hear it. And as someone who works with people who use substances to survive or who may have found themselves in with a substance use disorder, why doesn't she quit using? It just makes me awfully angry, too. I know that if a person, why don't she just leave? People who leave abruptly in a domestic violence relationship may find themselves dead very fast. And people who just quit using, too, may go through withdrawal and be at risk as well. And so these are not simple answers. Leaving and ending a relationship with a substance takes time. I don't like statements about why doesn't she pull herself together. If you're in, when you're someone with, for example, if a person has an anxiety disorder or suffers from depression, you can't just pull yourself together. You're going to need support and assistance. Or what's wrong with you is a very bad question. When there's nothing wrong with battered women, what's wrong is it's not what's wrong with the person, it's what has happened. And what has happened is that they've experienced violence at the hands of people they know or who are supposed to love and care for them, and that betrayal is a trauma. So people will do things that seem like, why would you do this, but that makes sense if you realize that they've suffered at the hands of a perpetrator for many, many years. Now, in terms of screening, I'm jumping up to, I think I've covered what I say on slide 26, so I'm going to actually move to 27. I'm going to talk to you about, if you're going to talk about substance use, you want to talk to everybody, not just one or two people. You don't want to just pick someone and assume to yourself, this is the person who is at risk for substances. You want to talk to every single person about it because it's part of a routine safety assessment and a risk assessment. And I'll give you an example. I was working with a woman from Pakistan, and I had my own biases. I thought she had told me that it was religion that had kept her going up till now, and that her faith had sustained her through years of abuse. And she talked to me about being a devout Muslim, and she actually talked to me about the fact that in her, you know, she didn't drink, she didn't, you know, use alcohol, drugs, etc. was just not done in her culture. And routinely, I said to her, well, I'm very happy that your faith has kept you going. This is great, and it's wonderful that you've been able to survive and do this. You have a lot going for you. And I remember thinking I wasn't going to follow up, because she kind of said that they don't drink alcohol, or they don't, she didn't smoke cigarettes or anything. I said, you know, it's interesting you say you don't drink and you don't smoke. Because I have to tell you, so many battered women I work with tell me that, you know, smoking something, taking a pill, or having something to drink can really help kill the pain. And so I'm wondering, do you have some other secret weapon that helps you as well? And there was a big pause, and she was very quiet for a minute. And then she said, well, you know, since you said secret weapon, I'm going to tell you a little something, she said. My husband, he hit me really hard. He beat me bad, and my head hit the towel rack. And when it hit the towel rack, it split open my head, and she was showing me the scar on her head and parting her hair for me to see. She said, see? And this, I knew I needed stitches. I'm a professional woman. I knew I needed stitches. And she asked her husband if he would take her to the hospital, because she was really worried. And he actually did take her to the hospital. They got as far as the parking lot, and then he decided he was not going to take her in. And he brought her back to the house and wouldn't let her go out and wouldn't let her have access to a telephone. And the next day it got worse, and she said it really hurt. And she said that it got infected and was all red, and there was pus in it. And she became concerned that it was going to be really bad. And during this period, she was watching TV, and on the TV came a commercial for Listerine. And it says Listerine kills germs and everything. So she said she knew she had Listerine in the bathroom, and she thought maybe she could put it on her head and that would clean the germs and kill the stuff that was happening with her head. And so she put it on a big old cloth or cotton ball or something and put it on her head. And what she said to me, I remember, she said, first it stung very bad, it burned and it hurt, and then my head went completely numb. And within a couple of days, she said, look, it's all cured, it's gone, all the pus is gone, all the red gone, everything. She said, isn't that great? And I said, yeah, that is great. And I thought, oh, that's a good secret weapon, you know, finding this. And she said, yeah, Patty, but you said secret weapon. I began thinking, you know, the pain on the outside of your head, as bad as it hurts, the pain on the outside of your head is not as bad as the pain on the inside of your head. You know how bad you feel when a person calls you a name or puts you down or makes you feel less than. And he said such hurtful things to me, I was always in pain. And I got thinking, this is medicine, this is good medicine. It killed the pain on the outside of my head. Maybe it'll kill the pain on the inside of my head. And my secret weapon, I drink this Listerine when I feel bad, and it makes, first it burns when it goes down, and then I feel nothing, Patty. So, there you go. And this is not a person you're going to necessarily refer into treatment. This is a person you're going to want to say, I'm sorry this happened. And in some cultures, by the way, saying you're sorry, the person will try to, it's not necessarily the best response. You might want to say, I feel bad this happened. I'm glad you found a way to kill pain both on the outside and on the inside of your head. I'm glad this happened. And Listerine is always going to be an option for you if you need it. But I have to tell you, there are some risks with Listerine, and I'm wondering if you would mind if I spend a couple minutes to talk to you about what they might be and ask you if you can think of any other safe, you know, a safer coping mechanism than Listerine once we discuss it, and giving her that information, that education. And because Listerine, of course, as you can well imagine, has a tremendous amount of not just the alcohol in it, but other things that can cause damage, liver damage and harm. And I don't want to get all excited and, you know, tell her, no, don't use Listerine. I want to say, yes, that your Listerine worked for you. It did the job. But it does have some side effects that could cause you some long-term health consequences. So
let's think of ways that you can feel supported and safe and deal with that pain that don't require you to use Listerine. Does this make sense to you? This is why we're doing the screening. It's not to get people out. It's to see, what are you doing? What's happening? How can we help? So your conversations need to be respectful and private. You don't want kids around. The communication should be age-appropriate. Of course, you're going to want to use an interpreter when necessary. Make sure that your comments are developmentally appropriate as well as culturally relevant. You're going to want to realize that people often find it easier when you first begin these conversations to talk about stress in their relationships or their partner's substance use before they talk about their own use and abuse. And they may be willing to discuss concerns about their kids as well. When you are talking to a person who is using substances or who has used them to cope or who has been forced to use them, their memory of events may be completely or partially unavailable. Elements might be missing or out of chronological order. And this is real important in terms of when you are a legal advocate and you're trying to figure out how to help someone write for the protection order, etc. A lot of times if someone's talking about their substance use, they tend to under-report it, and they may not be able to identify people, places, or details of every event that has happened. There are a variety of screening tools you can use. Slide 31 lists them. A good one is the CAGE, which is usually if you say, have you attempted to cut down substances, or are you angry when someone asks about your use, or guilt about use? Have you ever experienced that, or have you ever had a drink in the morning? Most people just say no. But it's a good tool in that you can look for the concepts that are illustrated here. And so for attempts to cut down, I'm wondering, you know, if this person is using substances, one of the things I might ask if someone tells me when I ask that question, you know, how often do you find that it helps to, you know, take a pill, you know, smoke something, drink something? How often how often have you found that useful? If she says every day or once in a while, I might say, well, has it ever gotten to be a problem in and of itself? Or have you ever felt has it stopped working for you? Has it caused any problems? Have you found that you had to quit and go on to something else? You're looking for themes, because when people determine that they have to cut down, a lot of times that means that the problem is getting bigger. And why we want to know if the problem is getting bigger is because the perpetrator may turn around and try to say that she's an unfit parent because of her drinking or drug use, or make threats around the drinking and things like that. So attempts to cut down, I might want to know, do you ever have a sponsor? How often have you been through treatment? What do you give up for Lent? You're going to have conversations to see if the person's felt the need to cut down. The children's advocates are often the first people to find out about the anger about when someone asks about use. And it may be that the person you're working with, you're helping them establish who can do child care or things like that, who can support them, and you find there isn't many people available. And we know that batterers isolate people, but substances isolate people too. And if you dropped your kids off and didn't pick them up for 3 days because you're on a cocaine run or something like that, or binging on meth, you might have burned out people who don't want to see you anymore, or if you stole their money or didn't pay them or something because of the drug use. You're going to find that there's disruption in relationships. So a lot of disruption in relationships may come from battering. It also can come from substance use. Guilt about use, you don't generally see substance use without some feelings of guilt. And it's not like, you know, I'm thinking of one of the women we work with who was talking to us about, she's in the domestic violence program, and she was sitting in group, and she was really upset and sharing with us how bad she felt because when her daughter was molested, she was sleeping. And we told her it's not her fault that it happened, that it's normal for a person to sleep at night. And that if her partner had harmed her child when she was sleeping, it spoke more about the partner than about her. She, by the way, had reported the incident to Child Protective Service. She turned the partner in to law enforcement. She took her daughter to counseling and treatment. You know, she told her daughter that it was not the daughter's fault. She did everything like as well as she could.
and she was extremely remorseful and taking active steps to get it to go. But every time we talked to her, she kept going on and on about guilt, about sleeping. And one of the women in the support group said to her, "You keep talking about the fact that you were guilty sleeping. I'm wondering, what are you really saying, that you were using something, that you were under the influence? Because I ask you this because when I was drinking and drugging, you could have put a train through my house and I wouldn't have heard it." And the woman started crying. Yeah, indeed, she was drinking. That gave us the opportunity to say, you know, whether you're drunk or sober, no one has the right to hurt your kid. But it's not your fault that it happened. The person who's responsible is the offender who did the harm. You know, if you hadn't have been drinking, you could have been at church, you could have been at work, you could have been sleeping. You could have been doing a host of things that are responsible. Just because you chose to have a drink, and you know, that does not mean that you caused this harm to happen. And if you're concerned about your drinking and drug use, we can help you address that and help you figure out ways to look at that. But don't mix it up and think that your drinking and drug use caused your child to be harmed. And I'm telling you, you have to give that message, because when women think that it's their drinking or drugging that caused them to be raped or their kids to be harmed, or that they're somehow responsible for the actions of a perpetrator, the guilt and remorse and shame and feeling bad about it will keep them using for years and years. And really, the person we, as advocates, our job is to hold people accountable. But the people we want to hold accountable are offenders and batterers, not people who are taking an occasional drink or using. That is not our mission. Does that make sense to you all? I hope so.
Patty, I wonder if we could just stop again for a minute
okay.
or two to find out if there are questions or clarifications people have on the line.
Okay.
So to all of you, I think you press number one on your keypad if you have a question or comment to make for Patty. Is that right, Carrie?
That is correct. All you need to do is press the number one once.
Are there any questions or comments at this time?
At this time, there are no questions or comments in the queue.
Okay. So,
okay.
Patty, let's go ahead for probably another, 15 minutes.
Okay.
And then we'll stop one more time.
For questions and comments.
Yep. We'll do a check, and then you can wrap up.
Fair enough.
Thanks.
Now, the last one on a case screening, we talked about attempts to cut down people who are angry when someone asks about use or if they experience guilt about use. The last one is IE for eye opener. And, you know, a lot of us think, you know, if you drink it or using first thing in the morning, that means you've got a problem. But I would say less than first thing in the morning eye opener, although that would let you know things have gone pretty far down. If someone is preoccupied with use, thinking about use, waiting for that next drink, has a pattern of use that's pretty common, that would be an indicator that coping mechanism is taking on a life of its own and might become a risk. And the kinds of things that you might see as people who are just waiting for 5 o'clock, or who are just waiting for, I mean, who are really preoccupied. And I'm not going to stay on the cage tool. I just want you to know, as advocates, you know, if someone says, "My husband won't let me go to an AA meeting," you're not hearing non-compliant with treatment. You're hearing, when she says, "My husband won't let me go to an AA meeting," you're hearing power and control. And what I would like you to do is look and listen when you are listening as advocates, when they're talking about their relationship with a substance. Look for ways to hear about those attempts to cut down, or listen for when a person is talking about someone who's angry over the use, or listen for things that might indicate that that person feels guilty about use. You're going to find over and over again, particularly when sexual abuse is present, there's a tremendous amount of guilt. I think I told you 74% of women in alcohol drug treatment have experienced some type of sexual assault or sexual abuse. 97% of women in alcohol drug treatment have experienced some type of interpersonal violence. And so it's not unusual that those things go hand in hand. I'm not going to go over CAGE-DV because you're advocates and you would understand this, but it's there if you're going to do any interactions and you want to talk to substance abuse professionals about recognizing the impact of domestic violence on the people they're working with. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the 4 P's, What we do know is that, and this again, just for education information when you're working with women using your services, that risk for substances being the not necessarily the best coping mechanism might be if a person you're working with has found it necessary to use substances while they're pregnant, or if they've ever had a problem with drugs in the past, or, you know, if their partner has a problem with drugs and alcohol and wants to drag them along with them, or if the parent themselves has been an alcoholic or addict. And, you know, the data is all over the map on that. Some data would indicate that if you have a parent with alcoholism, the risks go up around to 50% if you choose to use substances on a regular basis, and higher than that if you have two parents with alcoholism. So those might not be your safest coping mechanisms. You know, in terms of that framing, when I'm talking to people about what they're doing to stay safe or to address their feelings, I might say things like, you know, a lot of people I see tell me they feel stressed. A lot of people try sleeping or eating or shopping. Have you tried any of those ways of coping? Many women tell me the best way to cope is to smoke that cigarette, have a drink, or take something else. How often has that worked for you? Do you find it is still working? In terms of some screening questions to look and see if the partner is the user or abuser, to identify things as domestic violence that the woman may be experiencing, I might say, you know, a lot of women tell me their partners don't want to drink, drug, or smoke alone. How often do you find yourself using when you don't really want to? And then you can do follow-up questions to see if the partner's coercing them into drinking or drugging. Sometimes they'll say in the beginning their partner had them using all the time, but now they won't give them any drugs or they get them dope sick, things like that. Another comment might be, when a partner spends money on drug use, that is a form of economic abuse. Has your partner ever used food or rent money to drink or score drugs? If that partner is converting, you know, that is a form of economic abuse, to take money that's meant for rent or medicine or food or children's clothes or what have you, and to keep somebody short, that is a form of domestic violence. I find that if you ask a person about their drinking or drug use, a lot of times they, if you say, do you, they say no. And if you say, how much do you drink, they say one or two. I haven't met anyone that really says anything other than one or two. So when someone discloses to me that they use substances maybe to cope or whatever, I might follow up with, oh, so, you know, a beer can take the edge off. I'm not going to say, well, how much beer do you drink, one or two. I might say, what do you find you normally go through a day, one or two cases? And what happens is the average person just laughs kind of loud and go, no, are you kidding? We just have a six-pack. But if you say, how much do you drink, you just get one or two. And then, again, if they identify the amounts, I'm not trying to become the drug police. What I might say is, well, can you think of any reason why, you know, drinking a six-pack every day, you know, could be a problem if you're trying to access shelter, you know, if you're trying to maintain a shelter or you're trying to stay safe? Can you think of any problems with that, or can you think of what your, you know, how your partner might use that against you, or can you think of, you know, what some of the repercussions of that may be? A lot of times the victims themselves, people who have experienced this harm, they know everything, and they'll tell you. If you say to somebody, can you think of any reason why, you know, using this substance right now could cause you grief, they're going to tell you, there was a drive-by going by and the cops busted my husband or my boyfriend or my partner, whatever the case may be. They told me they would call up if he or she makes bail. If I'm passed out, I'm not going to hear the phone. If I have to go down for a protection order in the morning, I might oversleep if I've been using. It's been my experience when I'm under the influence, I don't run so fast. If I use, then he will tell everybody, or the shelter I want to go to doesn't let anyone come in unless they've been clean and sober for 24 or 48 hours. So they often have a list of those things, and it's better coming from them than from us saying you're not allowed to use. It's much better for them to determine what is the best thing for them and for them to come up with reasons why the substance use might affect their capacity to function. And so, again, good follow-up questions your partner may attempt. I would tell them, if you're in a custody dispute, it's stressful, partners can attempt to undermine your parenting skills. What are the reasons why drinking or using drugs might not could be harmful to your particular case? Can you share with me what your partner might say about your drinking or drug use? If they're able to safely do that in the context of DV, we might be able to come up with some fixes so that that will undermine the batterer's capacity to take advantage. And the batterer themselves might also be using, or we might be able to support a person coming up with ideas or a plan to counteract that. And if a person is using substances and you're concerned about their safety, we can encourage them to participate as an option to participate in a support group or to attend a program that addresses domestic violence and substance use issues. You know, we can make relationships with substance abuse professionals who themselves get domestic violence. When you are doing a volunteer program at your program, you can recruit recovering women and value them. Before we do anything, the most important thing we have to do if someone discloses they're using substances or they think that the substance use caused it, again, is to validate and say, no one has the right to hurt you. You didn't deserve it. It is not your fault if someone harms you, whether you're drinking or not. You didn't cause it. An abuser chose to be violent. We are glad you found a way to survive. Because, you know, drinking or drugging can kill pain for a while, but there are safer ways of coping that can cause you less grief. You deserve a lot of credit for finding the strength to talk about this. Your safety can improve your safety. Your safety is good for you, but it's also good for any kid, you know, for the kids and their well-being as well. So I don't think you can move forward until you validate, and you have to validate from the heart. You can't be just lip servicing it, because battered women got a BS meter. They can tell when you're judging them and when you think less of them. And you just got to remember that every one of you, there's probably one or two maybe, but most everyone has used something at some point. And people we work with aren't much different from us in that. And we want to let them know that when they're speaking to us about this, that we're going to value their confidentiality. We're here to support them. We're not looking at their drinking and drug use to give them the boot. We're looking at ways to help them get what it is that they hope to achieve. And women will tell you, I need more than a 12-step program, or it doesn't work for me. Or you can talk about all this spiritual treatment stuff, but if I don't have a roof, if I don't have food, you know, where am I going? When you're running for your life, you don't have time for any of that stuff. You're stuck on survival. And at the same time, a person may tell you, if I don't get clean, I can't deal with abuse issues. I used to think everyone had to get clean and sober first, and I thought everybody had to get safe first. Well, guess what? Each woman does it differently. Some women will work on their safety issues first, address sobriety if it's a problem. Others will want to go to treatment, and then the DV and the sexual assault stuff will clip up. Some people do bits and pieces as they go along. There isn't a right or a wrong way other than to be respectful, supportive, and offer people options and help them get the tools they need to do what they have to. In terms of a mini safety and sobriety plan, when I'm working with someone, I want to address what she wants to address. And so when we're talking, it's going to be about ways to reduce risk. And if risk is increased by use, how are we going to decrease use if that's necessary? What are the options to help a person keep safe? And if sobriety is an issue to their safety, how are we going to support that sobriety? If identity, who is a trusted ally and a safe sponsor? A lot of times women go in an AA or an NA meeting, there are things that are not quite aligned with how we operate in the battered women's movement, and there are some risks. And don't have a lot of time to get into all of that now, but the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, we have put together a manual that is available in both English and Spanish, which is called Real Tools. And you can download the entire manual at the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault website. And so we have 16 weeks of support group tools in it with handouts. And those handouts can be used in group or they can be used one-on-one. And we also have a series of articles and things that are of interest for advocates and maybe some for program participants that you could share with them. Again, it's in English and Spanish. and it might we have a chapter on, you know, how to kind of convert the 12 steps so that it's of use for people in domestic violence settings, or it kind of addresses the power and control dynamics and, you know, how that, because getting, you know, there's things in AA or NA that cause a lot of problems for battered women, and we want, because it's free and it's an option, we want to at least make it accessible, if possible, for some people who find it useful. About 67-70% of the people I work with can benefit to some degree from, when I'm talking about people I work with, I work with a lot of women with addiction issues who are also experiencing DV. They do okay with the AA, maybe 70%, but about 25-30% that no, doesn't work for them at all, and we come up with other ideas. And lists of ideas and groups are in the manual as well.
And is so, that manual in Spanish posted to the
it's
network?
It's in Spanish and in English, both. I have both.
Okay. And it's on the website.
It's on the website, andvsa.org. And we talk about referral resources, ways to plan escape from an abuser or escape from drugs, how to avoid dangerous persons, places, and things. And that could be in the context of, you know, the domestic violence, and also in the context of, you know, substance use if it's putting you at risk. And then tools. HALT might be... you find you're more likely to bail out of a shelter if you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You're more likely to bail out of a sobriety the same if those things are issues. And the other thing battered women shared with us is, you know, if you go to a program and you're told never contact your partner, you immediately your dialing digit comes out and it has to be done a day at a time, sometimes a minute at a time. And this seems to be true with people who are struggling with recovery issues or trying to get sober. You know, if we as advocates ask them don't ever drink again or don't ever use again, it's overwhelming and the person wants to use. And so helping them get through the day might be one of our, you know, support things, how to do things one day at a time, 1 minute at a time. And in the manual, we didn't have a lot of time to get into all of this. I'm trying to give you practical things, but there's a lot of things that are practical. I can't do it all in 90 minutes. But the manual has an article, and I believe also that Liz has a copy of it. It's called Advocates Ask, and that particular article goes in detail about the kinds of things you're going to face if you're sitting in shelter or transitional housing plan, and you're trying to figure out what do I do, where do I go, what do I do if this person comes in and they're using, or what do I do if this person is, you know, telling me stuff that isn't quite true or causing problems and conflict. So I have it all written down, and you're more than welcome to review it. And I'm always available. The network has no objections to me responding to questions by email or on the phone. If you want to run anything by me or do a case, you know, case consult with me at any time, I'm more than happy to respond. And it can all be done without breaching confidentiality if we do things in the hypothetical. I want to tell you that in rural areas it's much harder because you often don't have access to detox, etc. But if you're worried about someone's using, to pick up the phone and call. I mean, when it's prescription medication, you can call an emergency department or poison control. If you're worried about someone's drinking and drug, if someone passes out and you can't rouse them, you just call 911 like you would for anyone with an acute health problem. But many times the majority of people you're working with, it's often not a life-threatening situation, and the biggest threat is the perpetrator. Were you going to ask a question, Liz?
Yeah, I wonder if we can just take one more break to find out if there's questions or comments for the people on the line.
Okay, good.
Okay, we do have one question in the queue that comes from Minot, North Dakota. Your line is open.
Well, she already answered, or I was just going to ask which you should do first, the domestic violence or the substance abuse, but I think I heard her say you should take it on a case-by-case.
I wish there was a really, I wish you could just say, I mean, I was so adamant when I first got in, get clean first, no, get sober. Then I went and got the other way, get safer. But the women themselves identify what they need to do. And
and we put together an we talked to 142 battered women to kind of hear what they had to say, and then we compiled comments from 10. And you're going to see that they're all over the map on it. Some had to get sober first. Some had to get safe first. Some did this, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You don't want to get a notion that there's one way of doing it. And then the other thing you want to know is that, you know how domestic violence, some cases are seem to be more intense and more lethal or more, you know, there's all kinds of domestic violence when you're working with people. With addiction, it's not like addiction describes one particular way. There's early stage addiction, mid stage addiction, and late stage addiction. So our responses are going to be different depending on where the person is. And someone in the early end of things may easily just opt to go and deal with a DV first or even up to the middle, but it can shift depending on what they're experiencing and what their day-to-day life is like. So it's okay to be case by case.
Thank you, Minette.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Are there any other callers with questions or comments? We are about 9 minutes, I think, probably from the end of the call today, so we certainly have time for more questions and comments.
Can I ask a question for the group, and if they want to shoot it out, the answer, or, you know, I'm in a rural community. I mean, I live in Alaska. It's one of the most rural states. It may take us 3 or 4 days sometimes with weather is bad to get law enforcement in, and it's not easy to get someone into treatment in a minute. And I'm wondering if any of you are anxious about, you know, addressing people with substance use issues because you're in a rural arena and you don't know that you can get access to supports very quickly. Is that something that's a problem that you're facing, and do you have concerns about that you want to talk about?
Is there anyone in a particularly challenging geography that is having to contend with that issue and not have resources readily available?
Nobody's popping the button, huh?
Right. If so, press 1 on your keypad. I would assume that that's the case, Patty, and just maybe nobody that wants to
chime in. I just want to encourage you to think of the best question, the best tool that I use, and I didn't mention it because I've been rushing and trying to get through everything and not leave you without some practical tools. One of the most useful things you can ask someone, whether they're dealing with substance use issues or whether they're dealing with domestic violence, is to, first of all, to assume that you don't have the fix or the cure. But if someone describes issues around substance use, or to ask them, can you tell me what you've done up till now to deal with this? Because it's very possible the person you're working with has a set of strategies and tools around their drinking and drug use, just as they have a set of strategies and tools around their domestic violence. And so to realize you don't have to suddenly come up with a plan for everything, I think is very freeing. So ask them what they've done up till now to cope. Ask them about times in their lives when it's been challenging, but in spite they've had to get through something tough or demanding when use was not an option. A lot of people have to pull themselves together. We often worry about withdrawal issues. Withdrawal issues are most significant when we're talking about alcohol or when we're talking about prescription medication. Even though meth and cocaine are really significant, the biggest worry we have if someone's not using when they're coming down off of meth or coming down off of cocaine is not that they're going to drop dead from the withdrawal, but that they might feel suicidal or depressed. So you're going to want to work with them about, you know, what have they done in the past, how have they been able to pull themselves together, and, you know, to really look at supports that you can get. My experience in Alaska has been that our public health nurses have been a significant support and a big ally, and that when you are really stuck and you're not sure, that you can pick up the telephone and you can call you know, your local emergency department if you're worried if someone isn't breathing right or those kinds of things. But 90% of the problems that people experience that are using our programs is just day-to-day struggles getting through the day, trying to maintain sobriety and not being able to so that they could stay in. And so if you're able to
you know, incorporate some supports in your groups or your make your programs friendly, user-friendly for people with substances and accommodation. You know, to have books and materials and tools there that are helpful, you'll be moving forward faster than you think. There's a lot of online supports as well available, and of course, you know you have to engage in tech safety if you're going to use any of it. But those are things that we have found helpful in Alaska to refer people to. I'd like to close by, because I only got, I think, 3 or 4 minutes, according to my, I found a little clock here. I want to talk to you about specific safety concerns, just to close out, so that when you're doing your work, you're thinking about these and you're taking this into account. And it is that acute and chronic effects of alcohol and other drug use can prevent a person from accurately assessing levels of danger. So you're going to want to really, you know, when you do your risk assessment and talk to people about safety planning, that's an area where you're going to want to find out. I like to do a safety plan about what do you do if you're using, what if you do if you're not, what if you do if the partner is using. A person's safety is going to, when I'm safety planning with someone, most people who use, their partners are using too. And so how do you keep safe if the batterer is drinking or drugging? How if they're hungover and riled up? What if they're in treatment? What if they're not? You know, to look at the different kinds of safety issues. Somebody whose partner is using might be more at risk for acute punch in the head, but in early recovery they might not be hitting, but they might be stalking, tracking, and monitoring better. So those are the kinds of things that you're going to be talking about. And under the influence, many people feel an increased sense of power. So a perpetrator might, you know, be more aggressive at that point, even though it's not causing them, it's exaggerating it. A victim may feel under the influence that she or he, as the case may be stronger, and they may not realize the impact of the substances could cause them to have problems with their motor functioning and their reflexes. They may not be able to run, they may not feel pain, those kinds of things. And that substance use and misuse can impair judgment and thinking processes. What a lot of women will tell you is, when I start using, out the window goes the safety plan. So how can we make a safety plan to address that? And that alcohol and other drug use is encouraged and forced by abusive partners as a mechanism of control, and that a lot of sexual assaults, the person may very well have had their drink or drug doctored, and to really look at how to in safety planning, how to address those kinds of concerns. To talk in terms of safety, to remind them that abstinence and recovery efforts could be sabotaged. If you've got a woman who is going to a methadone program, a lot of people go get methadone. They get a dose at a set time of a day. The batterer may know that day or time. We may need to get a protection order to keep them from being at the methadone clinic at that day and time. That perpetrators may, to acknowledge, you know, I don't like to just say, well, here's the number for 911 or call the protection order. If you're working with substance abusing women, you need to find out, are they going to be able to call 911? Is it an option? Are they more afraid of the response to their drug or warrants for drug or alcohol behaviors? If that's the case, you know, what do you do if you don't want to call the cop? And when will your staying alive be more important than your fear of the warrants? To get this through as something to be thinking about. To recognize that withdrawal symptoms, you know, and compulsion to use is going to have an impact on safety. And, you know, so that if the person gets sick and tired of having to contend with that, to remind them that there are other options available. To understand that, keeping appointments, et cetera, may be a problem if someone's using, or that someone who is using substances may show up at the shelter, stay 3 days, bail out, come back, bail out, come out. Don't think of this as a waste of time or why are they coming in because you got to do this paperwork. If that person is only able to stay, you know, needs the safety for the 3 days and then blows out, our mission as advocates is to provide that safety on autonomy. And it doesn't say that if you're a battered woman, you've got to be somewhere 28 days. If you look at fatality review reports, you see how many women who are killed by perpetrators also have a substance use issue. You'll feel a lot better about letting them keep up with you for the 24, 48, 72 hours that they can manage before they feel they have to go out, and get on their own again. I think this is really critical. In terms of safety, you want to understand that women in recovery who've got long-term recovery may find the stress of securing safety leads to relapse. It could be a one-time thing. They may be ashamed or afraid to talk about it. You want to let them know that you can link them up with options and that this is a normal thing. And also to remember that people who are using may not be believed. And so you want to still, even though it's not necessarily wise to believe everything they tell you about their substance use, it's really important to believe what they tell you about abuse and to realize that lying in the context of substance use is an indicator that it's a big problem. We know that battered women don't feel safe disclosing domestic violence. You need to be aware that substance-using women don't feel safe disclosing substance use. And they will be able to talk about it when it's safe to do so and when the time is right for them. Don't re-victimize. People don't choose to develop the disease of chemical dependency any more than they pick out batterers. You want to think before you speak, how would you like to be spoken to? Offer respect, not rescue. Options, not order. And realize, you don't know until you have that first drink if you're going to be an alcoholic. It could take years to figure it out. You don't know the first time you take a drug or if it's for an illness or an injury and that it's going to turn into something else. We don't know when we engage in relationship the first time that this person is going to be an abuser. Everyone goes out on a date. Everyone tries something to feel good. And it's very unfortunate if someone finds themselves with an abuser or with a substance abuse problem, but it is not a choice. You don't choose to be an addict. You don't choose to be, a victim of domestic violence. These things happen. And our job as advocates is to support people and help them feel that they have options and choices, to treat them with dignity and respect, and to make sure that they have an equal access to justice, an equal access to safety and autonomy to decide how and when they're going to do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty. Thanks very much. And to all of you, thank you for joining our call today. It was a pleasure to have Patty on the line. I hope you all have found it valuable today. To all of you, I'll talk to you again next month, I'm sure.
And thank all of you who did take the time, because I really, as an advocate for battered women with substance use issues, I really appreciate your interest and your willingness to do the hard work it takes to provide the good advocacy and support for women with multiple issues. You deserve a lot of credit, and I appreciate the work you do every day. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an important topic. And thanks to OVW for making these calls possible. So everybody take care, and I'll talk to you again.